host, Pete Socks, a Catholic book blogger, and today we're going to be talking about something a little different and a little the same, but we're going to weave some Star Wars into today's episode. I'm here today with Philip Kozlowski. He graduated from the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota with a bachelor's in philosophy and Catholic studies and completed his Master of Arts degree in theology with the Augustine Institute. He's a writer and author of In the Footsteps of a Saint, John Paul II's Visit to Wisconsin. He blogs at philipkozlowski.com and writes to help all Catholics master the art of prayer by conquering the practical obstacles that prevent a fruitful relationship with Christ. And today we're going to be talking about his latest book, The Last Monks of Skellingmichael. Welcome to the show, Philip.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're quite welcome. So I want to set the stage for today's show. And as I mentioned, we're talking about your book, The Last Monks of Skellingmichael. So first off, to set everything up, what is Skellingmichael?
Well, Skellingmichael is a particular island. It's more of a rock, really, off the coast of about 7 miles off the coast of Ireland, off from County Kerry, and there's really two rocks. There's a smaller rock and there's a bigger rock, and then on this bigger rock is where this monastic community built up their life there for about 600 years.
Gotcha. So, again, you say they lived there for 600 years. Why? And I guess let's weave this into the whole context of the thing, because this is, I believe, why you wrote the book. And this is probably going to be the coolest episode I've done yet. But this location became noted for being the final scene of Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens, and it's been confirmed it's the opening scene to Episode 8, The Last Jedi, where Luke Skywalker and Rey meet, and people may not fully understand how rugged this terrain is. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. Well, it's... The island, as you said, became more well known from especially the last scene of The Force Awakens, and in that last sequence, you can see it's just this this tower of rock, and there's really nothing much on the island except for some grass and then rock, and then the monks, and then also in the movie you see Rey going up to meet Luke Skywalker, and she has to ascend these countless steps, and I think there are between 600 and 700 steps that they have to go all the way up to the top. And actually, kind of a funny story that I learned, it's not in my book, but when they realized that they had to go back to The Last Jedi to film scenes on Skellingmichael, they approached Mark Hamill, who plays Luke Skywalker, and they told him about it. And before he had to go all the way to the top in 45 minutes, but the second time around, they gave him about an hour and a half because it just took. By the time he got to the top, it was really difficult for him, and so it's definitely a difficult terrain, and it's bare, and it's not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, actually, I have that quote here. It was he mentioned it in a recent Vanity Fair article, and his quote is, "When I read the script for Episode 8, I went, 'Oh my God, we're going back,' because I said I was never going back." and then he also goes on to say how he cluelessly thought there might be something like a landing pad at the top for a helicopter. So I guess what this brings to mind, and you discuss it in your book, why did the monks choose such a setting as this to live in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and certainly and then also, I guess, included just about Skellingmichael too, is it's an isolating island, and it's very difficult to access. And this is, all this played into the role of why the monks chose this island. You know, they knew it was difficult. They knew it was off on its own. And they chose that for the purpose because they wanted to dedicate their lives to God, and they wanted to imitate the desert fathers, you know, those who in Egypt would go out to the desert, like St. Anthony the Great, and to find the remote, you know, the most remote place possible where they could just focus on prayer, contemplation, work. And so in Ireland, then this took, you know, there aren't, you know, sandy deserts in Ireland, but there are, in a certain sense, green deserts. And so this is what developed at, you know, being inspired by the desert fathers. They took that same idea, applied it to Ireland, and then sought out the most remote places, you know, that they could find, where they could be alone, sheltered, away from the world. And then also connected to it is they developed at the same time this idea of a green martyrdom, which, you know, not necessarily connected to the green landscape, but it's, you know, we have red martyrdom where you are killed for the faith, or white martyrdom where you suffer you know, persecution for the faith. But then there's what developed in Ireland and other places, the green martyrdom, where you freely chose to do extra hard, difficult penance for God, as kind of a one way where you can still participate in martyrdom, even though you know, you weren't killed or persecuted for the faith.
Right. And actually, I'll take a quote here from your book where you discuss that green martyrdom, which is an interesting thought or theory, because I've never heard of it until I read your book. And you pull it from an ancient homily that you says written around the 7th century, and it states there, "Now there are three kinds of martyrdom which are accounted as a cross to a man, to wit, white martyrdom, green, and red martyrdom. White martyrdom consists in a man's abandoning everything he loves for God's sake, though he suffer fasting or labor thereat. Green martyrdom consists in this, that by means of fasting and labor, he frees himself from his evil desires or suffers toil in penance and repentance," end quote. So in essence, it's more of a martyrdom through labor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's one of those, Ireland's kind of unique in terms of how Christianity, you know, flourished in the, you know, first couple centuries, because there really wasn't any, you know, persecution from the outside. There wasn't bloodshed, as is often the case. And so, you know, from what I've read, some of the, you know, early Christians were kind of, I don't know, felt that, you know, they weren't able to do something like this, or to give their lives for the faith in that regard, but that they could at least, you know, toil, you know, under the labor of the earth, and to do that for God, and then that would be a worthy kind of substitution for, you know, the supreme sacrifice of your life.
So can you tell us a bit, what in your research, what did you find? I mean, we're talking about a culture that survived for, you know, 600 years. They lived on Skellig Michael. What was their day-to-day life like?
Sure. Well, it's certainly, you know, it's kind of an interesting life, because it's in Ireland, you have the Western world, the Western influence, but then there's also this Eastern influence from the Desert Fathers, and so this Irish monasticism was a bit of both worlds, where you have kind of this dedication to hermits, you know, kind of being solitary, you know, living in a community, you know, but, you know, they had kind of their own little huts on the island that they could retreat to, but then also in community, so they did work together, and they would, you know, they over time, they developed a similar schedule to, you know, say like the Benedictines, kind of a work and prayer, just throughout the whole day, you know, praying the, you know, what we now call the Liturgy of the Hours, the, you know, praying the Psalms at specific times in the day, you know, in the morning, you know, mid-morning, you know, lunchtime, afternoon, evening, and then, you know, nighttime, and just infusing everything with prayer. But then also taking, you know, some influence from, you know, kind of the repetitive prayer, similar to, you know, most, a lot of people know about the Jesus prayer, praying, just trying to pray without ceasing and to really do that with their whole lives. And you know, and they did, and they had a, they had some work on the island too. I mean, they first of all they had to build their huts and their dwellings, and they had to carve everything out of rock by hand, and that in of itself took them, you know, several generations to do that, and also to try to find food, and which is not difficult on the island that they live on. They lived on, you know, they could have, you know, scrounge up the eggs that they would find from the birds that would perch there. They could fish from the coastline. But then they'd also would have to, you know, go. They wouldn't be. They couldn't be completely cut off from the main island, and they had to, from time to time, get such necessities as, you know, as bread and wine for the sacrifice of the mass, and also mm-hmm. other, you know, necessities so that they could actually live on the island too. So,
Well, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back to discuss more about the monks of Skellig Michael and some Star Wars information. So with that, we're going to take a quick break. We're here today with Philip Kozlowski speaking about his book, The Last Monks of Skellig Michael. You're listening to Red Box. Famous. We discussed last segment, Phil, just how difficult it is to get to this island once you're there climbing it, the hundreds of steps. Rumor had it on the filming of episode 7 that Mark Hamill almost died from a fall, which he says never happened, but, you know, who knows. Anyway, it was not easy terrain. And if you look at the island, there's a lot of stone huts that the monks had built. And I thought it was rather interesting in a book you talked about this network of caves and huts and compared it to a beehive. Being that this island's so remote and so, you know, rocky, how did they even do that? Were the caves there? Or did they have to build these structures?
Well, I mean, they did have, you know, it's lots of rock there present. They may have brought rock from the mainland too to help in their endeavors, but yeah, like I think I said previously, it was, you know, they didn't have, you know, very technical tools, and had to do everything by hand, and it's really remarkable when you see the, you know, see the pictures of this island and the huts that they built and the staircases that they built, and you know, they hollowed out cisterns for the water to rainwater to fall into, and you know, it was quite difficult to do that, and to do it by hand, you know, it took them, you know, it didn't happen overnight. It took them many, many years, many generations of monks. And it, you know, it's very rough, but what's amazing is just the fact that it still exists, you know, today, that, you know, the work that they did it very deliberately, prayerfully, but they did it well as well. In a certain sense, they didn't build it just for a temporary living space, but they, mm-hmm. they built it to last for, you know, over 1,000 years.
Right.
So,
and it's still there today. Obviously, it's been used. Now that begs the question: you know, why did they even leave? Obviously, they spent a lot of sweat equity into making this at least a livable area for the life of a monk. The solitude of prayer and whatnot. Why did they totally abandon it and walk away from this island?
Yeah, and you know, in a certain sense, you know, historians they don't know exactly. You know, there are certain theories, but in general, historians believe that it was mainly due to changing in just the church's hierarchy and system of monasticism. You know, kind of like I said, the Irish monks were kind of a mix of East and West. You know, the Eastern traditions of the Desert Fathers and hermits, kind of solitary living, kind of on your own. But then also they had a lot of connection to the West, and you know, once different, you know, like Saint Benedict came and founded his monasteries, and his rule began to be spread. It became much more, you know, the power in the church became more centralized, and these different monastic communities that were kind of, you know, both, I guess, figuratively and literally islands, they couldn't really. It was starting to not be allowed as much, and the local. The local bishops kind of wanted to oversee these different monasteries more, and so it became to a point where they just had to. They realized that they couldn't live that kind of island dream anymore. They couldn't live at the edge of the world. That they had to come back and to live more in the world. And so at a certain point they left their island, and then they did live for a time just across the bay, kind of overlooking Skellig Michael and their former monastery, and so you know, and from that time on they took kind of they still were active in the monastery. You know, pilgrims would come and they would, you know, take them to the island, or maybe a monk wanted to go kind of on retreat, and so they would return to the island for those things, but mm-hmm. but they weren't able to stay on that island permanently anymore.
Right. So I suspect one of the reasons you wrote the book was the Star Wars connection, am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, you and I are pretty much the same age. I grew up with Star Wars, although I was pretty young at the time when the first one came out. And then we had George Lucas come out with the original, with the prequels, which we won't discuss that. what's really gotten in reading your book, but even before reading your book, what has really amazed me looking at Star Wars and then flipping through the pages of your book, like the one drawing here where you show the monks in their habits, in their clothing, that's a Jedi. Is the how much George Lucas drew from different religions and at least a pretty big part of it's from Catholicism and early Christianity.
Yeah, and that is kind of an interesting thing. You know, even though George Lucas himself, he grew up Christian, kind of in a Methodist tradition, but he did draw a lot from the Catholic faith, and you know, the even just the famous words, you know, "May the Force be with you," was deliberately recalling the words, you know, may the Lord be with you, that we hear so often at Mass, and then also I did a little extra research just to see, you know, how much it had influenced him early on. And I guess in the early drafts, when he was thinking of how to, or of this, you know, this space opera, as he often would mm-hmm. call it, that the Jedi were called like these Jedi Templar Knights. And it's, you know, recalls the Knights Templar, which were an actual monastic order that engaged in battle. And so, you know, even though some of the philosophy of the Jedi that kind of later was developed is much more Eastern in terms of like Buddhism or looking towards like the samurai figure, you know, a lot of the influence, though, too, was from Catholicism, and it is interesting, you know, that the new directors chose Skellig Michael for this, for the location of the first Jedi Temple, and so kind of in a sense retracing those Catholic roots of the Jedi, maybe not knowingly, but. It's certainly fascinating, and you know, it's interesting just how the directors, they were looking for a place that had, you know, an authenticity to it, and in more ways than one. Not just that was in the real world, but it also has, you know, an authenticity of a spiritual authenticity that kind of matches, you know, what that. You know, that spiritualism of the Jedi. So it's very fascinating, and definitely it's in there.
Well, we're going to take another quick break, and we'll be right back here on Breadbox Media. You're listening to Off the Shelf with Pete Sock, the Catholic blogger, here with Philip Kozlowski, speaking about his book, The Last Moments of Skellig Michael. We'll be right back. Talking about the Catholic connection to Star Wars and George Lucas's hints of different religions within the series. He also pointed out that continued beyond George Lucas, and actually with Rogue One, which Lucas had, you know, pretty much nothing to do with. And the phrase that popped up here that you speak about at the end of your book, you tie it to the Liturgy of the Hours, where we say, "O God, come to my assistance, O Lord, make haste to help me." When the character Chirrut in Rogue One says, "I am one with the Force is with me." So I think it's interesting that tie-in continues even with a new set of hands laid upon the Star Wars legacy.
Yeah, it seems that, you know, when it comes to things spiritual, that the directors, they look for, you know, kind of what I said previously, kind of some things that are authentic and rooted and ancient. And, you know, when it comes to the Catholic faith, you know, we have all that. We have we are rooted deeply in history, and we have a rich patrimony of faith. And I guess, and we've also just, you know, the Western culture is so infused, whether we realize it or not, with the Catholic faith or Christianity. And so it is interesting how in these new movies that, you know, it just keeps on popping up, and that the Catholic faith is still kind of infused in it, not knowingly, but because it's such ingrained in our culture that it just you can't get away from it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And one more thing, this cover of this book, that logo you have is pretty cool. Did you design that, or is somebody come up with that for yourself?
Well, I helped in the design, but yeah, I did have someone else help me bring that into realization.
That's pretty cool. So I want to segue here a little bit into some of your other work, because as we mentioned earlier, you tend to write a lot about prayer. And when I was researching some of your other works to prepare for this show today, you know, I discovered you have some pretty awesome books on prayer. One of them I like to talk about is the book Distractions, a step-by-step guide on how to stay focused during prayer. Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
Sure. I guess when I approach prayer, sometimes, you know, I've read a lot of books and a lot of articles on prayer, and, you know, a lot of the time they talk about kind of general principles of prayer, and kind of but often these prayer books, they don't go into, I guess, the basics, kind of our experience of prayer, because, you know, when we sit down to pray, it doesn't always just happen. And I think for a lot of people, that can be frustrating, that, you know, you read the lives of the saints, or you read a specific saint talking about prayer, and it just seems like such an amazing experience. But then when we sit down to pray, it doesn't happen. It doesn't work like that. And so what I try to do in some of my different books, like the Distractions book, is just go through some practical things, you know, practical distractions, you know, just even basically, you know, sometimes when we go down to pray, we just have a tendency of always looking at the watch and saying, well, how are we done yet? Or, and so I try to offer some just basic advice of how to overcome some of those basic distractions, so that you can actually focus on praying and not on these other things.
Right. And can you give us some of those tips? Because I think, you know, in today's world, we're so distracted, we're so connected, that even when we do sit down to pray, if we don't have, you know, the cell phone on the other side of the room, there's sometimes the temptation to pick it up. So how does one in today's, you know, world turn all that off?
Yeah, it's definitely difficult. But the good news is that if you are deliberate about it, that it is possible to turn off those extra distractions. You know, one example, you know, and it's really quite simple, but we don't necessarily always think of it, is to make a specific, you know, prayer corner, or to even just take out a specific image of Jesus or Mary that we can have before our eyes, to kind of just sanctify our space, because, you know, we might be asleep or trying to pray on our bed or on the couch, and we kind of look around and we just might be distracted by all the different things. But if we set a part of our house or an apartment to pray, then we can kind of, you know, kind of make it a little chapel, a little oratory, where we, you know, we may not be able to go to church or the Adoration Chapel, but we can at least go to this little corner of our house. And then it's kind of like going to church, where we can kind of put things aside and just focus on this one thing that we're doing, which is prayer.
Are there any particular prayers that you use that you can recommend to us?
There's certainly, a lot of different prayers that we kind of have to discern kind of what, you know, where does God in my heart, where does he want to take me, you know, and we kind of have to start with baby steps and to, one of the greatest prayers that I enjoy is the Liturgy of the Hours, and that, you know, that's kind of has a steep learning curve for some, but I think it's a beautiful prayer, just praying the Psalms, and it really connects you with the church, but then it helps you formulate your own prayers, just because the Psalms are written from the heart, and so they can speak to your heart.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned how it's a steep learning curve. Things are a little easier, but it puts you back into the trap that we talked about earlier. You can get an app on your phone that'll guide you through, but then you got your phone back in your hand. So another one of the books you have that I think is pretty neat is, it's called the Horarium. I hope I pronounced that right. A Simple Guide to Creating a Daily Prayer Schedule That Will Change Your Life. You mentioned the Liturgy of the Hours, which actually puts you on a cycle if you follow it and are intent upon it. Again, steep learning curve. But how does one develop a daily schedule that lasts? Because I'm reading the description, you say developing a daily schedule that will not only endure for the rest of your life but also change your life. So the key there is that it sticks.
And that, I'm definitely a firm believer of that. If you want to dedicate your life to God and you want to pray more, that you really need to schedule it. Because we can have the best of intentions and say, well, I'm going to pray for 10 minutes every day. But if we don't actually sit down and, either open our appointment book or put it on our app to schedule, it won't get done. And so, really, the key that I see in that is, typically speaking, but say, for a lot of people, they work, 9 to 5, and then they have family afterwards, and kind of between those hours of, say, 9 to 9 or 9 to 8 or something like that, those hours of the day are really hard to predict, at least for people who have families or for people who are just living in the world and working. So really the prime time for prayer is either in the morning or at night. Fulton Sheen, he had a quote that I use a lot, that you have to figure out if you are a rooster or an owl. And then once you figure that out, if you're a rooster and you really love to wake up in the morning, or if you're an owl and you're, a night owl and you like to stay up at night, that you have to, once you figure that out, then you can look to those kind of two blank slates, the morning and the evening, either waking up earlier or, going to bed later, that you can carve out time in those time slots to pray. And then if you at least start with that, then you'll be on a good path where you can at least keep that for a long time.
Right. That's true. So we've talked about distractions, we've talked about a schedule, and we've talked about using some sort of holy images to keep one focused. Obviously there's other things. You could get up and go to a chapel, and you could do that if you can work out in your day. We talked about finding the morning or the evening. What do you recommend to make that? I'm going to get back to that sticking thing, because, I've had that problem in my own life where you start, you're on a good thing, and then you just drift away from it. Something happens that occurs that skews your schedule, and then you never get back to it. Is there anything that you can recommend to help people just stick with it, or is it just a matter of willpower?
Well, it's really, I guess it's a combination of things. First of all, it's, recognizing doing kind of a little spiritual inventory and just seeing, finding out who you are and where you are in your spiritual life. And then it's being, I guess, you know, and this might be harder for some than others, but just being a planner that really, because I guess a lot of us, we don't really necessarily have a daily schedule that we live by, but the key is then adapting a new habit of scheduling, of actually having a daily schedule. Mm-hmm. And so that's a habit that you have to learn and adapt to. And, you know, just like, and just like anything, it, you know, if you want to learn something new, learn a new habit, you have to do it. But then what's also good is to tell someone else about it and so that they can keep you accountable. Right. At least in my experience, that I've, you know, if I want to do something like that or start that kind of schedule, I have to, you know, in my situation, you know, tell my wife about it. And then, that kind of doing that, just even the fact of telling her brings that idea that I have, and it gives someone else kind of someone else can kind of keep tabs on me, and then, you know, it creates a little more pressure on me to know that someone else knows about it, or, you know, talking to a spiritual director about it as well, or a priest, or someone that you you know, a good friend that you know. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, then it helps you keep me a little more accountable for what you do. It's definitely not it's not easy, but I guess with the help of God, you know, and obviously going back to that,
yep,
you have to also, if you want to do something like this, you need to do it first with God, to ask for his help, to ask the help of your guardian angel, and then it is possible. So
awesome. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about your other book, In the Footsteps of a Saint, John Paul II's Visit to Wisconsin. It sounds like an interesting tale in that book. You've been listening to Off the Shelf, Your Own Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger, and we'll be right back. Segue into another book of yours, Philip, In the Footsteps of a Saint, John Paul II's Visit to Wisconsin. It's a narrative of his visit to Wisconsin, August 23rd through 24th, 1976. And to set the background of this was a trip that then Cardinal Wojtyła made. It was basically a tour of the United States, correct?
Correct, yeah. And the reason why he came to the United States was because he was invited to give a homily at the International Eucharistic Congress in Philadelphia. Hmm. It was from August 1st through August 8th of that year in 76. And then in addition to that, then he kind of toured some other areas. He really liked to visit, in particular, areas in the U.S. or wherever he went that had Polish immigrants in. So...
Well, I have a story to share. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but in Pittsburgh, he visited during that tour, a church called St. Stanislaus. And I heard this story when I went out to visit my friend Mike Aquilina there, and he took us on a tour a couple places in Pittsburgh. And when we were in there, he said, in that day that Watiwa visited the church, there was a cleaning lady in the church, and she was up front cleaning, and she heard someone come in the front door of the church, turn around and look, and it was a gentleman in priestly garb surrounded by some others. He came in to the middle of the church and in clear Polish said, "I am home." Proceeded to go to the front of the church, kneel on the kneeler, and pray before the Blessed Sacrament, and she eventually figured out it was Cardinal Watiwa, who is in 2 years going to become Pope John Paul II. And actually today, if you go to St. Stanislaus, the priest there has turned that kneeler into a relic that you can pray at.
Oh, wow.
So that's a little story from the trip. So after he gets done in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, he heads west to Wisconsin. So what did John Paul II do in Wisconsin?
Sure. Well, it's definitely kind of a strange stop on his tour because, you know, typically he visited a lot of, you know, major cities, and which kind of makes sense. But essentially what happened is there's a very large population of Polish immigrants here in central Wisconsin, and it's one of the largest areas of rural Polish immigrants. So and at the time, there's a public university here, and a professor there was very good friends with the cardinal in Poland, not Cardinal Wojtyła, and actually invited him to come over to speak at one of the lectures, Polish lectures. Cardinal Wyszyński. So the professor here invited Cardinal Wyszyński to be a keynote speaker at one of the events that he was having on Polish lectures, but he couldn't make it, so he said, "Well, I know another cardinal that would do very well," and so he passed the invitation on to Cardinal Wojtyła. So Cardinal Wojtyła was kind of the second best invitation. So then Cardinal Wojtyła came to Wisconsin, and it was a little bit difficult to get there because we don't have a central or a large airport. So one of the companies in town had to fly their private jet down to Chicago to pick him up, to bring him up here. And then besides giving a lecture at the university, he celebrated Mass and then had a big picnic at one of the Polish farms out in the country, and just kind of got to he said one of the reasons also why he wanted to come is because he was the only thing he ever saw in the U.S. was concrete and skyscrapers, but he never got to see the green of America. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to be able to see, you know, farmland and him loving nature. He really enjoyed that.
Gotcha. And I stand corrected. Did a quick search here. Pope John Paul, Cardinal Wojtyła, was in Pittsburgh in 1969.
Oh.
So it wasn't his first trip to the United States as a cardinal. So what made you want to write a book about, you know, that visit? Obviously, it was an obscure visit, as you mentioned, because, you know, it wasn't a major city. What sparked your interest in writing about it, and how long did it take to research that? Because, again, it's an obscure visit that, you know, I never knew about until seeing your book.
Yeah. Part of it is, you know, this is a place, you know, where I grew up, so I knew the places where he visited. Then I guess kind of connected to that, now with the canonization of John Paul II, what I wanted to do is kind of, you know, bring to light just, you know, kind of the, you know, the title of the book, In the Footsteps of a Saint, how just you know, really bringing the importance of just the fact that, you know, a saint kind of walked in, you know, in these places, these ordinary places that we know of, you know, in this, you know, obscure place in Wisconsin. And, you know, and it's important in the sense that, I guess maybe more locally, but also broadly, like in the United States, we don't have a lot of, you know, like Europe has, you know, saints kind of in almost every church, and you can mm-hmm. kind of walk down the street and find all different kinds of saints. But in the U.S., not so much, and at least at this point in our history. And so it really kind of brings you in a special connection to the saint, something that you wouldn't normally have. And then also just showing just kind of through the stories that I compiled, just kind of the ordinariness of a saint, just how, you know, saints aren't, you know, always these, you know, these people of distant ages and distant places mm-hmm. That we don't know, but they're much, you know, they're much more ordinary than we think, and they just lived with extraordinary love. But they, you know, they did ordinary things like us, and so that we can too become a saint, right, following in their footsteps.
You know, I think it's important now for us today, with seeing these people that we've actually been able to, I mean, not personally interact with Pope John Paul II, but, you know, through the power of television, through the power of the media, we've seen these people in our lives, and now they're becoming saints. Another example is Father Stanley Rother, who will be beatified soon. Just really good people that, you know, you talk about St. Therese or St. Francis. These are people that were hundreds of years ago. So there's distance not only in time, but in touch feel type things. And I think it's important now that we're seeing these people that we actually were able to see or to find a YouTube video on of them giving a homily or something. That's important to bring the reality of sainthood to us and prove that point that you said, that they're ordinary people just like you and I.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, and that's the beauty of it, that, you know, really it's, we're all called to become saints, and it is, but it is possible, you know, we we can become saints too, and that's the beauty mm-hmm. of the Christian life.
Most definitely. So, Philip, it's been great talking to you today. Really enjoyed your book, The Last Monks of Skellig Michael. I was drawn to it because of the scene in Star Wars. I know you wrote it because of the scene in Star Wars. Great book. Again, you write a lot about prayer. You have a number of outlets you write at other than just your books. Can you tell us a little bit about where we can find your work, and do you have anything else in the works that you'd like to share with us?
Sure. Besides my own blog, which I don't write as much for anymore, but I do write regularly for a website called aletheia.org. And you'll find I write, you know, a couple articles a day for that website, and I write a lot about similar topics of prayer, just kind of the heritage of the Catholic faith, and then also too, I write for the Pope's Worldwide Prayer Network, which is more commonly known as the Apostle of Prayer, mm-hmm. As well. And in terms of what's next on the horizon, well, there are some kind of dovetailing off of this book, The Last Monks of Skellig Michael. I had this idea of making it into something to kind of connect between, again, using a connection between Star Wars and the Catholic world to make a comic book for geared towards younger audiences that features this this community of monks on Skellig Michael. And it is I've written the script for it, and I have an artist who's working on laying it out into a comic book format. So that's kind of an exciting project that I'm interested in to again, kind of bridge the gap and to look for ways to participate in the new evangelization that are new and that, but bring people of different age groups in contact with the Catholic faith.
Right. Right on. Awesome stuff. So thank you for your work. Thank you for writing about prayer, because I think it's important in today's time that people take time out to do that, but they need to understand how, where, when, and you cover the bases very well. So thank you for that, Philip.
Great. Thank you.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule, Philip, spending time with us. You've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sopcich, Catholic book blogger, and until next time, God bless.